What's up, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Going Deep podcast with Aaron Watson. Today's episode is one that I considered not putting out, so I have to add a little disclaimer to it. The audio quality about 35 minutes in gets a little dicey. We recorded this at our guest Po Shen Lo's office right by the Carnegie Mellon University campus. And Poe's very busy getting his company and website XP off the ground. So we recorded in his office, and due to that fact, there was some other noise going on from the office that starts to really hurt the audio quality about 30 to 35 minutes in. Considered not putting it out there, but figured you're all big boys and girls. If you don't want to listen to it, if it gets too much to listen to, too much of a pain, then by all means, hang on and wait for the next episode. But he's a really, really smart guy, really, really insightful. Didn't know if I'd be able to get the time to sit back down with him. So I still wanted to release it. Poe is an incredibly, incredibly intelligent guy. We talk about his company. He talk about learning. We talk about his time on the U.S. National math team, a bunch of other really good stuff. I think you're really going to enjoy it. And if you bear with me on the sound quality, I promise you, I tried a couple different things. Couldn't make it any better than it is. So hope you enjoy. And without further ado, Po Shen Lo. So I'm here today with Po Shen Lo. I'm really excited about this interview. Po, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks.
Po is the founder and CEO of XP. He's going to tell us a little bit today about his process in creating that, what XP does, and also some of his other very, very impressive academic accomplishments. He's a PhD from Princeton, currently on the faculty at CMU. So we're going to get into all that, but to start off, Po, could you give us a little synopsis of what XP does and how you got started?
Absolutely. So XP seeks to help everyone in the world learn math and science in a very exciting way. So we took a page from Wikipedia, and we learned that perhaps the best way to have the entire world share knowledge is to have the entire world help create the knowledge together. And our goal is to create a product that everyone can learn from, which is free, and which is somehow 10 times better than what they were used to before. But what does 10 times better mean? Let's think a little bit. How long is your typical attention span? In fact, have you already zoned out? How many seconds do I have before you zone out?
Not very long.
If that's the case, then perhaps the best student-teacher interaction is interaction. And if you look at the sorts of educational materials available today, say a textbook or say a bunch of videos where you just sit passively watching or reading, that's not getting at what we just said about this attention span. So when I'm saying about 10 times better than what's available today, our goal is to create something which is interactive, where as a learner, every few seconds, you answer a question or the video has stopped or you think about something analytically before you go on and move forward. There's actually a term for this, it's called active learning. And what XP solves is it solves the problem that programming these active learning lessons is an enormous amount of work. So I grew up in a generation where I think it's quite similar to many other listeners of this podcast, but there were these books called Choose Your Own Adventure. I loved these books. I thought it was so much fun to be able to read a book and every page make a decision on whether I was going to go into the cave or run away from the monster. There was only one part of the books that I did not like. I was a first grader or second grader or whatever, I forgot. But the thing I didn't like was that the stories were really short. In fact, it felt like even though I'd borrowed this big fat book from the library, I was done in about 10 pages. I didn't understand, of course, back then as a kid, that the reason it stopped at about 10 pages of depth is because if you have two choices every page, the number of pages in the book at depth 10 is about 2 to the power of 10, which is about 1,024. So actually, you see, it wasn't even 10 choices. I mean, just as a kid, I remember thinking, oh, so few choices, such a thick book. I just didn't understand the mathematics of exponentials. But now let's draw that back. We've just established that there's actually an exponential growth in the amount of work required to create something interactive. And in my opinion, that's actually why you don't see interactive resources widely available, say, on the internet or anywhere else. That doesn't mean they don't exist. In fact, they do. And in fact, you can often pay subscriptions for them, and it's something that you would have to purchase. But our goal was to actually put an interactive lesson in the hands of every human being on the earth, whether they live in a country which happens to speak the language, which is spoken by much of the wealthy world, or whether they live in a country where the language they speak is not matching where there is a lot of economic opportunity. Why I'm emphasizing that is that if it takes this enormous amount of effort to create the interactive lesson, and you live in a country where it's hard to monetize on that, people won't make the lessons for you. And so the insight that we made when I was thinking about XP was that perhaps the way to get these interactive lessons in the hands of the whole public would be to copy a page from Wikipedia's playbook, which is called crowdsourcing. Let the entire world together contribute in creating this the programming of this interactive resource, instead of having a team of 10 people or 40 people or 100 people trying to create this for everyone. Let all 7 billion people in the world work together, and furthermore, let them work together at times when the topics are really fresh on their heads. I mean, there are other insights on XP too, such as, I believe that in some sense, as soon as you have just gotten through and learned a topic, you might be quite well equipped to explain to someone else who's just hitting that sticking point, and you might be able to explain to them how you got over that sticking point. In fact, I remember when I was a college student, I wanted to become a teaching assistant for a math class I took immediately after taking it, because I felt, I remember what's so hard about this class. I want to share this with all of my classmates because I remember how I got through every sticking point. I actually even went to the math department at Caltech and said, can I TA for free? I just want to share this. They thought it was a funny offer in the sense that they liked the offer, but they commented that if you're doing it for free, well, there's some chance that halfway through the semester you'll say that you're not interested anymore and they'll be stuck with no TA. So that's why that didn't happen. But now, drawing it all back to XP, with this method, if the whole world together can create these interactive lessons, sharing knowledge right when they've figured out how it is to attain that knowledge, you have a possibility of creating a resource 10 times better than what's currently available for free.
Wow. A lot of interesting stuff in there. I guess you keep coming back to getting your inspiration from Wikipedia and the way that Wikipedia is crowdsourced. Do you see yourself as a competitor of Wikipedia? Do you see yourself as a continuation of Wikipedia? What is your mental framework for seeing this, you know, very well-developed crowdsourced resource and comparing it to your much younger venture?
Oh, great. Well, thanks very much for pointing that out exactly. Because actually, one thing that we need to emphasize is that we're actually not Wikipedia. So I mentioned Wikipedia because it's the easiest thing for many people to anchor on and to draw an analogy to what XP is. But I'd say that oftentimes when you design a product, you want to focus it, you want to think about what's your user's objective when they use your product. I would say that Wikipedia is a product that's designed for reference, or for looking something up, whatever that's supposed to mean. Typically, that means extracting some fact or even looking back on something that you have seen before, but generally already having some context of what you're trying to read. I consider that to be a crowdsourced reference. There is not actually a product yet to help, a crowdsourced product yet to help learning. Learning is different from reference. In learning, you don't necessarily want an enormous wall of text, like the extensiveness of a single Wikipedia article. Instead, you'd rather have some sort of an interactive conversation with a virtual tutor, which is only going to give you snippets at a time, and preferably is going to respect your attention span, which is about 5 seconds. So our product is directly focusing on the educational aspects. So in fact, the Wikipedia part is the part we've already built. And in fact, I can say even then, even though I'm saying it's the Wikipedia part, it's not even exactly Wikipedia. Let me comment on a few distinct differences.
Sure.
Yeah. The first one is that on every topic, there's actually more than one article. So for example, on the topic called gravity, right now on the site today, I see two articles. By the time you listen to this, maybe there'll be even more. But the way it works is at each topic, there's voting going on between the articles to find out what's the most exciting way to explain the topic. Notice I emphasize the word exciting. I really think that's very important. And with the multiple perspectives, you're sort of making a Yelp or a Quora or a Stack Overflow. Those are more technical, but everyone uses Yelp. But like a Yelp for that particular style of, that particular topic, to find out through the voting, what's the best way to explain it. That solves a fundamental problem that Wikipedia and other typical educational materials have in the eyes of most people, many, many people, which is that unfortunately many people consider them to be maybe a bit boring. I personally don't find them to be so boring. I personally enjoy learning, and I think there are many other people in the world who do. But one has to respect Bill Nye the Science Guy for realizing that it's possible to actually make certain educational topics really interesting. And so there's a reason why I think most textbooks and things like Wikipedia need to sound more balanced and more level. It's because they have only one take on the subject. If you're going to have one take, it should be the professional take. However, if you have the liberty to allow the world to create an entire array of different styles and flavors, it's like Baskin-Robbins ice cream. If you're only allowed to have one flavor of ice cream, I bet your ice cream shop would just have vanilla. And you're going to Baskin-Robbins because you don't just want vanilla. So in some sense, the point of this major deviation from Wikipedia right here is that we actually think that by letting everyone have Cherry Garcia and all the other great flavors, actually we'll be able to make learning fun. We're not actually trying to crowdsource a Khan Academy or crowdsource a Wikipedia, that's a funny statement, or crowdsource a textbook. We're more interested in trying to crowdsource Bill Nye the Science Guy across every topic in math and science, and eventually into other areas as well. So that's a major differentiation from Wikipedia. There's one more major differentiation, which is that it's interactive. So these lessons actually are designed in a way that you should be able to interact with them on a per second basis. And so in that sense, we are crowdsourced like Wikipedia, but our focus is on educating the world. And Wikipedia's focus, I think, is on providing a reference for the world. And we target our product to deliver on the learning.
Gotcha. As far as that interaction, you mentioned that there's multiple articles on a single topic and that there's a system in place for which, you know, one article will essentially rise to the top as the most exciting way to learn that topic. Is that an upvote downvote system similar to Reddit? Is there a rating system, like, you know, how many stars something got? Can you talk a little bit about that process and how you chose that specific process as a way to find the best possible article?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in fact, that's a question we were just discussing in the office over there yesterday. So right now what's going on is we're using an upvote downvote system, which is, I think, more similar to Reddit and Quora. Although our upvote downvote system right now also doesn't weight every vote equally, because if you are going to make a crowdsourced system where a large number of the users are going to be seventh graders, some of whom have an interesting sense of humor, you don't exactly want to have a completely equal vote on everybody. For example, you might hope that somebody who has established reputation on the site has a bit stronger of a vote. So in fact, the way the community is currently set up is that the power of your vote is higher if you have written articles that other people have also upvoted. Well, when I say other people have also upvoted, I mean, you don't really need a whole mountain of people to upvote your content to declare that you're good. But if a power user upvoted your content, that also indicates that you're good. So it's sort of recursive in the sense that your reputation is based on how many thumbs ups you've gotten from people, but it takes into account their reputation. Wait, but their reputation is based on the reputation of people who voted for them. By the way, what I'm describing here is Google's PageRank, why Google came across, I guess, around 2000 and became the best search provider was because it found a way to rank websites based on their reputation. and the reputation was based on whether there were reputable websites pointing to them. What I'm saying is this is a parallel. What we're using here is a parallel to what Google used to identify reputation among websites on the internet. We're using a similar algorithm to identify reputation among human beings. And instead of having links from website to website, we have these votes going from one human being endorsing another human being's content, so to speak. So in some sense, this is using mathematics. I mean, using various areas of mathematics, and we're using that in order to create, hopefully, a richer experience that will augment the typical upvote downvote system, so that it won't just be, oh, it's got 3,000 votes from seventh graders, right? You actually want something which, by the way, I'm not putting down seventh graders at all. I think seventh graders are awesome. The only thing I worry about is if a bunch of seventh graders decide to have fun and randomly vote oppositely to what they want. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But in any case, that's what we're currently using, and we'll continually keep adjusting our system in order to deliver the best possible experience.
Absolutely. We definitely don't want any seventh graders hijacking the system at
yes,
all.
Yes.
Seems like it's a very, you referenced Google multiple years back for their PageRank system. It seems like it's also really a system that's predicated on the slow building momentum of the community that's involved with XP. So you mentioned right now that you're very much in the STEM fields, math, hard sciences, aspiring to and hoping to one day cover a much broader spectrum of topics and genres. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges with just getting this off the ground, getting initial interaction? Because I think what a lot of people don't appreciate with a website, such as another crowdsourced website like Wikipedia, is that, you know, it seems like it has every topic under the sun now, but at one point it was still very niche, very specific. So how did you get the ball rolling? How did you get that initial set of content?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. So first of all, I should say that indeed right now we're STEM, math and science, although ultimately the vision of XP is to cover every topic that at least 100 million people should know. In some sense, that's another big differentiator between us and Wikipedia and Quora. I would say that the missions of Wikipedia and Quora are to cover these 100 million topics that anyone might want to know, which is a very broad array of topics. Some of them are very specialized. Our goal is to completely nail all of the heavy topics. Now that I've said we want to hit everything that 100 million people want to know, that's actually still a lot of things. In fact, that's basically education. And that includes social studies, history, geography, English. Or if you're in a different language, if you're in a different country, maybe Portuguese. But you can't start there, just as you had commented. You've got to start somewhere where you have a base and where you, I would say, where we understand a little bit better the subject. So I'll actually draw another parallel as I'm answering your question. If you think about it, there's another website for online learning called Coursera. And Coursera actually was started by a team of professors at Stanford. And one of them, the first thing he did was to teach his class through the internet. This class was machine learning, an advanced computer science class. And around there, it continued to grow. I happen to be the national coach of the United States Math Olympic team and a mathematician. So for me, the natural place to start was in mathematics. And also for me, I mean, thinking from the point of view of a website that's trying to gain traction, I also thought it probably would gain the most traction if you started with the biggest market. So rather than starting with my research, which is combinatorics, where I would say that is a subject that maybe 0.1% of the 0.01% of the population really studies right now, I would start with something that 99.9% of the population studies, called high school math and high school science. So that's why that was chosen as the initial region. And it was important to be able to choose an initial region which both had a big market and for which I and our team had a strong operating knowledge in. So that's why we went for math. But now there's the question of, well, if you make this site, why will anyone write anything in the site? So there's another key insight in creating this, which is that actually there is an incentive for people to write a lesson on XP. And that incentive is something that not everyone will realize, but if you think about it a little, you'll realize that it's actually true. And that insight is the best way to learn anything is to teach it. Actually, if you think about how many people were suggested to review in their classes, oftentimes the teacher would say, copy your notes. I mean, even though you've taken notes, copy them again. That's an act of teaching it to yourself. I myself, when I was learning math and science and everything else, I didn't actually direct copy the notes. What I would try to do is I would try to regenerate the notes without just word for word copying and explain to myself, sort of like teaching myself. I felt that worked a lot better than, for example, reading a book or watching a movie. However, what I found out is that if I ever were to teach a course or be a teaching assistant for a course or tutor someone else on that topic, man, then I'd really get it. It's
Absolutely.
because that's the act of trying to explain to somebody else. And so on XP, the people who are actually writing the articles now, I wouldn't be surprised if they are among the people who have learned the most from the site because they have written the lesson. They've written an entire automatic module that explains how a topic works, why right answers are right, and also crucially why wrong answers are wrong. And that's a rare thing, doesn't usually happen in school.
It also seems like it's an opportunity for the contributors to be creative. So they could look at a page and say, well, here's four ways to teach this lesson. I wonder if there's another angle, another way that I can offer it. Because I remember I had a friend, I'm not going to call him out, but in fourth grade we were learning division, and it math was not his strong suit. He was having trouble with division. Our teacher tried three or four different ways to teach it to him. Finally just said, we just need to take a break, take a breather from this and come back. And me and my buddy kind of showed it to him another way, and it started to click for him. And then all the other ways that he'd been taught funneled into bringing together his understanding and knowledge of how to divide numbers. That's a very basic example, but having those different creative ways of teaching the same lesson seems like a real strength of your resource, but also, like you said, a great opportunity for the contributors.
Yes. And I should say, in some sense, things that make people want to contribute to projects is they feel like they have something they want to share with people. I mean, I think it's a human instinct that oftentimes people think that they have an idea and they want the world to know the idea. They don't necessarily want to be paid for the idea. And in some sense, it doesn't really make sense to be paid for something that it doesn't take so long to write. You know what I mean? It's like when you post on a forum. I don't really expect someone to pay me $1 for what I post on a forum. I just wanted to post it on the forum because I want people to see it. I'm proud of my idea. And so with this, the enthusiast community was actually the first community that went on and started populating lessons. You see, this is why I had the confidence to go and drive this project forward forever from the beginning. It's because I saw a few things. I saw that A, this resource was not available and it would be very useful. B, that people who are writing this resource will gain a lot by writing it. And see, there's an enormous pool of enthusiasts out there, like who, like me, when in college, would have just wanted to do this for free because it's fun. And in fact, in some sense, I think that a lot of things that are created in the world that are awesome, such as Linux, are created by enthusiasts who just want to change the world. And in some sense, that's who we are. That's how we came together to build this thing. But I saw this big pool of enthusiasts because I actually work with the Math Olympiad team. These enthusiasts, I'm not talking about my direct students. I'm just saying that there's this maybe this alternate social community which extends across the entire world of the people who do math team in school. Who like to stay behind and do interesting math problems, and also just to hang out with each other and think about how they might be able to change the world some way or the other. I love working with students because everyone's idealistic and it keeps me idealistic. In some sense, I don't exactly want to want to grow up, so to speak. But nevertheless, by working with all of these people, you get this insight that there are probably 10,000 people out there in the world who would love to be part of a community like this, who would love to share their insight, and for whom they would actually gain something by writing the article. They would actually have learned something a bit deeper, and B, they would have changed the world by sharing their knowledge. So, since I knew that these communities were around, we went and built the initial version of the platform, and then we actually opened it in May of last year. When we opened it in May of last year, we didn't want to put it on say Reddit right away because you wanted to know what sort of feedback you were going to get. So in fact, the way we grew from 0 users to some number was that we posted on Facebook because at this point, since a lot of the people on the initial team were deeply plugged in to the enthusiast network, the enthusiasts saw that, oh, we have seen a lot of other online ed websites pop up. And this one is the one that's somehow created by the enthusiast community. And let's join this. So that's actually how the growth began. I myself actually am an enthusiast through and through. Ever since I was in middle school, I was really into doing all of these math contests and science contests, and I loved that community. So in some sense, when I wanted to build this, it was a way of uniting all of that energy, which sometimes had been going off into different directions, into creating a resource that could help everyone in the world.
Absolutely. You've mentioned here the U.S. International Math Olympiad team here. For listeners at home, Poe was a silver medalist back in 1999 for Team USA. He also was kind of an assistant coach called the deputy leader in 2004 and from 2010 through 2013. He's currently wearing a Team USA shirt, and he's the national lead coach. Was back in 2014 and is again this year. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to be involved with the Math Olympiad team and maybe how that's impacted your academic career and life outside of academics?
Sure. So I would say that I attribute a lot of what I ended up doing to having been brought into this alternate universe of math and science activity in middle school. Actually, it was by the generosity of a parent of an eighth grader in my middle school who wanted to coach the middle school math team. And they brought me along when I was in sixth grade. And that's when I suddenly learned that, wow, there's a lot of interesting stuff out there. Math is not just adding things and subtracting things and doing normal problems in school. It's actually about thinking. And so that led me to keep driving higher and higher in all of these math events. And I guess that brought me to college, and I went and did other interesting things there. And I guess I always felt that I wanted to maybe try to give back to the community that created the opportunities for me. So whenever I had any opportunity, I actually wanted to go and coach other students. When I was in high school, I was coaching the middle school math team. When I was in college, I was actually I was a really, really low-level coach at the National Math Olympic team, helping to grade papers for the top high school students at the time. And I just kept staying in it because I love working with students who I see as perhaps a former version of myself, and I'm trying to help them receive all of the opportunities that I got because somebody else was generous to me when I was at that age. So there's just this certain attitude that I have, which is that I guess I feel that people have done great things for me, and I want to make sure that those opportunities are available later. And now, with regard to becoming the head coach of the Math Olympiad team, at some point, you're the guy left standing, so to speak, in the sense that I just kept staying with it. I kept doing all sorts of different tasks. Whenever anything is falling through the cracks in organizing some event or another event, I'll jump in and I'll try to make sure it works. And that's just because, it's not because that's my job, it's just because I don't want a person who is sort of like an earlier version of me to be in a situation where suddenly something they were expecting to happen, like some event, some math event, to suddenly fall through because of some technicality, right? So it's just, that's just my attitude towards these sorts of things. And I guess that has driven a lot of my decisions on becoming, I guess, now the national coach of the Math Olympic team.
Absolutely. I think that's a very realistic and maybe less glamorized explanation of how one comes to a position of leadership. You said you were essentially the last person standing or catching the stuff that falls through the cracks. I think a lot of people have a tendency to, when they are describing, you know, how they came to a position of leadership, to say, well, you know, I went above and beyond. I using all these romanticized visions and terms to explain how they reached that position. But I think that's a pretty insightful explanation of how you got there. The team has finished in the top six for the last half decade, maybe a little bit longer. And you yourself were a silver medalist when you actually competed with the team. What's it going to take for the U.S. to be number one?
That's actually why I started XP. So basically, there was a year that we lost. So we usually lose to a country like China. And we say that, well, China does have four times the population of the United States, and therefore they have a natural advantage. If you're sourcing a team of six people, there's a natural numerical advantage that would be very hard to overcome. Then you lose to South Korea. South Korea's population is about a factor of 5 or 6 less than the United States. That excuse doesn't hold anymore. So that year that that happened, I started thinking, and I thought, how can it be that they're doing so well? Because actually in the United States, we actually are lucky enough that we have some very, very good institutions of higher learning. In fact, everyone in the world wants to come to the U.S. to go to college. Actually, that's an overgeneralization. I shouldn't quite say it that way. But I'll say is the United States universities are very popular. That's definitely true. Even at the high school level, we have some pretty good, I would say, magnet schools or academies. So in some sense, we're able to teach at the highest end. But then the thing that clicked was I thought about, if I'm not only interested in the highest end, suppose I'm only interested in, say, what the median US math student can do, and compare that to the median South Korean student, at that point you start to worry a little bit. I mean, you may have heard about these, I think it's called the PISA survey or something like this, where the United States came out towards the bottom in math and maybe in physics, I forgot the other one, although it did come out number one in confidence. By the way, I think confidence is really important. We need to maintain that one, okay? but nevertheless, I started to realize that maybe the problem is, although we have 5 or 6 times as many people as South Korea, if you look at how many people have strong mathematical ability, whatever that's supposed to mean on some absolute standard, maybe South Korea actually has more than the United States. That could be true. In fact, I'm not saying we should go into their model. Their model has people studying all day. And I'm not saying that studying is bad, but in some sense, having a variety of experiences is also important. I'm actually an American through and through. And so what I realized is maybe the way to eventually win the International Math Olympiad is not to keep pushing and pushing and training this very small handful of people at the top. Not that we shouldn't, we'll keep doing that. But also to make sure that you build that base up so that our natural population advantage is fully engaged. So that's actually what XP is for. In some sense, the mission of XP is actually to take the number of people who love math and science and multiply it by 10. And if you do that across the whole world, in some sense, in other countries, they already have that engagement. In the United States, I'm not completely sure. But my guess is that we might be able to be a strong beneficiary. The United States might be a strong beneficiary of getting more people just interested in the field. And in my opinion, once people are interested in something, there are already plenty of great resources online, whether on XP or on other websites, and that will contribute to a base which numerically is then able to compete very strongly with almost every other country in the world.
Absolutely. I guess beyond that, though, so if we raise the median mathematical skills of the average US student, that doesn't mean that we're going to all of a sudden have, you know, many more math teams. There's only one team, USA Math. They have 6 students, like you said. A lot of these people are going to end up not going and getting a PhD in mathematics or a master's. They're going to, you know, go out and find a, not a regular job, but another profession, another line of work. What impact or effect do you think that that will have them having a stronger mathematics skill set?
Oh, I love this question. So I like to say that I think math could use a rebranding. In particular, I like to call it thinking.
Okay.
So, to me, math is not just about memorizing that 2 plus 2 is 4, or that 5 plus 7 is 12. I think that the math in the 5 plus 7 is 12 is actually more about possibly even noticing that 5 plus 7 is sort of like 6 plus 6, because you can move one from the 7 to the 5. And the fact that they're equal lets you connect both of them to 12. As opposed to saying 5 plus 7 is 12 because 5 plus 7 is 12. 6 plus 6 is 12 because 6 plus 6 is 12. Does this sort of make sense? I'm binding the two things together. And in some sense, if you learn math and develop, learn this thinking method, like learn math as a problem solving or as a structuring of all of the information, you actually can crystallize a lot of knowledge into smaller ideas. And let me even give an example of the insights with XP. So many of the thoughts that went into creating the design of XP came from looking at a problem which was called massive global education and thinking about how to break that apart into the small pieces that would then get solved in novel ways. So when I'm talking about getting people better at math, I'm actually most interested in letting them see, of course, the old ways of doing things. Not old, actually classical ways of doing things, which you must see, like how to solve equations, which are with an x squared in them. Those are important and interesting. But while doing so, you can actually crystallize some knowledge of why those equations work. Does that sort of make sense?
Absolutely.
To me, the math is all about the thinking. And in fact, even at the International Math Olympiad level, I should probably comment that that math test that the students, the math contest, is not your standard math test. It consists of 2 days. Each day is 4.5 hours and has 3 problems. And if you can solve one of those 3 problems, you're a genius already. How? 4.5 hours, 1 problem? The problems are actually all about proofs. They're all about trying to show that a certain thing is true. It's a reasoning thing. It's not calculating out some long, laborious number. For example, this is not a question that would appear on the Math Olympiad, but here's a proof you could talk about, which is that there are infinitely many prime numbers. A prime number is a number for which the factors are only one and a sum. So for example, 7 is a prime number because it doesn't divide into, doesn't split into anything but 1 times 7. But on the other hand, 6 is not a prime number because you can break it into 2 times 3. So proving that there are actually infinitely many prime numbers is a theorem that was done many, 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 many years ago. But the notion of trying to prove a result is actually the heart of the International Math Olympiad. And this thought process of thinking and proof and analysis are actually what I feel would be the most useful for everyone today.
Absolutely. Does that come across in your in-person teaching? So you are in the faculty at CMU, you're very involved in XP, you have these other things you're involved in. When you come back to the classroom, is that a major focus of your lesson, or are you, or I guess how do you incorporate that? Because there is just the hard analysis, the critical thinking that you have to teach your students. How do you get that across to them?
Right. So I would say that the lecture style that I like to use is not a lecture. In fact, I don't really like lectures. I do more of a crowdsourced problem-solving session in which I'll say, we want to learn this today. What should we do? I'll say, here's a fact. This is something that's true in combinatorics. Like, the number of ways to arrange 7 people in a row is 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. Why? And then I'll start to get ideas from the class. And as the class provides ideas, I'll sort of moderate the discussion. We'll see it as a problem-solving method in which we have collectively discovered how to prove this theorem. So instead of me just going up and saying, class, the way it works is like this. You know, this is what's true, and here's how you could see it to be true. I want them to discover it themselves. And so the lecture is one where there's a lot of back and forth. There are a lot of ideas coming from the class. I'll moderate them. So if it's clearly going into the wrong direction, maybe I'll help and I'll draw it back. But my favorite lecture style is actually where I basically put a question on the board and we just start crowdsourcing ideas and students start to say, oh, I think we should try this. And I'll write a number one and I'll write their idea. And someone else will say, oh, I think we should try that. They're at number two and they write their idea. And this goes on for a while. And then suddenly somebody's going to say, oh, wait, I want to take idea number 4 and idea number 7, combine them, and add this other insight. And I'll say, great, okay, that's idea number 10. After a little while, someone says, okay, I get it. You take that idea number 10 and you merge it with like this other thing, now we're done, right? But then the students have seen an entire board filled with this almost Thomas Edison process of being wrong 99 times and then being right once. And then they finally understand, oh, that's how that crystallized proof or argument came out. It wasn't just that somebody got a stroke of lightning, a brilliant judgment, and then understood. It's that everyone tried all these different ways of understanding why this might be true, and then finally found this circuitous rug that gave you the solution.
Absolutely. And that's obviously models your method at XP very closely, but it really, just bring it back to how it applies to day-to-day life, is if you're able to really explore and think in this way, regardless of the topic, regardless of the problem that you're facing, if you are a lawyer, if you're a botanist, if you're a mailman, it can be an applicable process to basically anything.
Absolutely, and that's why I like to rebrand mathematics as thinking. In fact, I've worked with plumbers And I think that they actually have very interesting problem-solving procedures that they do every single day when they go in that house, especially a Pittsburgh house. You see, these, it's not just that it was the first time that it was plumbed. It's probably the fifth time that it was plumbed. And then their first job is to understand what the heck's going on. What did plumber number one do? What did plumber number two do 20 years later? You know what I mean? They're doing all these problem-solving. And so to me, if people have learned how to do this generic problem-solving, I actually think that will increase productivity all over the place. And personally, from my own experience, that's actually also why I want to share this with people, because I started with just the core problem solving in mathematics, and I used it eventually when I was in college to even understand things like physics, or I used it to understand things like computer science. Or today, I basically apply these generic problem solving techniques every single day on running a business. And it's all about being able to look at the problem, whatever the problem may be, analyze it critically, find out, abstract out what are the core challenges, what are the core objectives, and find your own very creative and unusual path all the way through. I emphasize the word creative. I think that actually the best innovations are done when you, it's not where you have made something which is just fundamentally impossible to make. In fact, I'll say if you do that, that's great, but that's rare. Oftentimes you've just found a better way to connect ideas or components that nobody else had thought of assembling in that way before, that suddenly create, as a compound, a revolutionary product.
Absolutely. You have a very, very well-developed pedagogy or philosophy about how to teach and how students learn best. Do you have role models or mentors in the field of education or in mathematics that have helped you in developing this view, or how have you come to have such a crystallized philosophy?
So I would say that my role models would be all the people who came before me in some sense. You see, that's exactly what a mathematician is. A mathematician, I'm talking about now a research, professional research mathematician. I mean, your entire job is to think about how to crystallize the ideas that other people have done before and find new structures in very abstract mathematical systems, so to speak. I certainly really enjoyed working with my PhD advisor, because I thought that he was very much on top of things. He also was the sort of person who could do everything, including I even watched him sell a car at some point. I mean, the guy was amazing. And he was also an excellent communicator. So I guess what I should say is, with regard to role models for analytical thinking, I find those everywhere. I was particularly inspired by some people who not only have that ability, but also have extremely good communication ability and interpersonal ability, because that's sort of a proof of concept that it's possible to be able to think very deeply and still relate to normal people. And I aspire to work with everyone in the world, whether they are normal or abnormal or really abnormal or really normal, whatever all those things mean. I actually think the world is 7 billion very interesting people. And to have seen that it's possible to kind of bridge every world at the same time, I find very inspiring. That's what I aspire to do myself.
Absolutely. As far as how that relates back to XP, you've talked a lot about maybe the kind of the initial stages and your vision for it. But before XP existed, before, you know, even we had, before we even recognized the fact that we have zero users, where did the inspiration come from to create your own unique resource?
Right. So I can actually trace that back to being seeded from certain conversations. So this is after Coursera, after Khan Academy, after many of the first attempts to produce online education websites. And when those other ones had come out, I thought they were very interesting. And in fact, at some point, I was even approached by colleagues at CMU, not by the university, but just by colleagues at CMU who were considering possibly building a MOOC. So that's what they're called, Massive Open Online Course. And they were approaching certain faculty members who they thought might be suitable for piloting a few of the first courses. They chose them carefully. And when I was approached, I thought, well, first of all, I'm very honored that you would ask me as one to be one of these people. But at the same time, I said, I'm not sure it's worth the time, because if I go and create this course, and if it's just about the same quality level as someone else's course, maybe a little bit better, okay, maybe I think I'm a good teacher, maybe it's a little bit better, But due to the fact that they don't have professional recording equipment or professional video editing or five cameras in the room or a Hollywood quality makeup crew, you name it, right? It won't necessarily be the best. And if it's not the best, does the world even need it? I mean, maybe it makes whatever company we're trying to create more valuable. But I guess my personal interest is in leaving a mark on the world. So I said, I'll do it if you get me a huge budget, get five cameras in the room, and we make the combinatorics class, that's my subject, the combinatorics class to end all, in the sense that we'll make the best one the world's ever, never going to need another one. That's totally ludicrous, by the way. There's no such thing as the best one. But we'll make one that we really meant to do it well, right? In some sense, Hollywood knows that you're supposed to spend multi-million dollar budget, multiple cuts, multiple angles. But, you know, if you did that, you'd actually have contributed something that people can use later. I didn't want to make another class with another $1,000 budget. Obviously, we didn't move forward with this because we didn't have the money to, right? But when I had that conversation, then I thought, hang on a second, this is kind of interesting. We have a lot of duplicated work going on. We have a lot of people all trying to create things with roughly similar budgets, roughly similar technologies. Does the world really need all of them? Maybe the world actually needs something that will collate all of them, where they can all come together and they can all be voted upon. And then we can just share the best ones. For example, rather than just having a website which is just my course or just my videos or whatever, maybe it's better just to have a website where you are just a bunch of pointers that say, if you wanted to learn this, go there. If you wanted to learn this, go there. But those are different places. Those two theirs are different theirs. Then over the course of the summer, I have also something called the Hertz Foundation Fellow. My graduate studies were supported by the Hertz Foundation, the Fannie and John Hertz Foundation. Same Hertz as in Hertz Rent-A-Car. And the history of that fellowship is actually that John Hertz was a friend of Edward Teller, who was key in the during the Cold War in the Manhattan Project and all of these major activities that were essential to the national security of the United States. So during the Cold War, this fellowship was started, and what they did is they supported about 10 or 15 people every year for their graduate study. They chose 10 or 15 new fellows every year to study for PhD in math or science, not really math, more like applied physical sciences. And if you accepted this position, accepted this offer for full tuition, free study, you signed a little form saying if the United States ever needs you, you have made a moral agreement to help. I'm actually one of these guys. So the idea was, in case you ever need another Manhattan Project, you could suddenly go and call on this group, and suddenly you've brought in the 10 or 15 best people from every graduation year for the last 40 years, which is your Manhattan Project overnight. This was the thought process in the Cold War. We don't need another bomb. Nobody's using the idea of making a bomb here. But actually, for all you know, if there's a major national security issue like Ebola someday, if that really were to come sweeping across into the United States, this could be mobilized. This force could be mobilized. Anyway, so I'm one of these guys, but they bring us together because we're a community. They bring us together about two or three times a year, and they always have interesting talks. And the one talk, which was the timeline of this, is like, this talk was probably about a month or two before founding XP. They actually brought in an interesting speaker to talk about education and the future of education. The person was named Peter Norvig from Google. And I guess at that point, it finally made me, it clicked. I wasn't interested necessarily in doing any of the particular suggestions that were proposed at that conference. But it made me think, maybe the time is right. You know, maybe the time is right to go and try to coordinate a team together to build this index of content. That's not the current XP, by the way. What I'm describing here is basically a set of bookmarks, which is categorized by the subject you might want to learn. And all each page has is a pointer saying, the best lesson to learn this about, the best lesson to use to learn this is there, or it's here, or so on. And people would vote on it. Then the idea of XP just continued to evolve, and the key insight was, wait a second, if you're going to store a string of text that says the lesson is there and put a URL, if you're going to store that in your system, you can store the whole lesson, assuming that the lesson consists of text and questions and a link to a video. And so that's how XP was born. It migrated out of just a list of bookmarks into actual interactive lessons hosted on our own service so that we wouldn't be in danger of the other services suddenly disappearing. You know, if you have a link and the link is broken, what can you do, right?
Absolutely. And it's important to recognize that even if such a remarkable project such as this isn't necessarily have an end goal of making a huge profit or being a for-profit enterprise, money is a part of the equation. We're in the XP offices right now. I met a couple of the engineers before we sat down. They're busy working away right now as we speak. And in September of 2014, you got $1.3 million from a first round of outside investment into XP. As XP developed, I'm sure at some point you recognized that this was a must. You had to get this outside investment in order for the project to grow at the speed that you envision it. Can you talk to me a little bit about the process of going and finding outside investors? Were there multiple options as far as who to accept money from, or were you soliciting investment, and how you ended up with the four investors that you have?
Sure. So I should say from the beginning, I was not sure whether to put this as a for-profit or a non-profit. Not because I don't think it can actually be self-sustaining. Actually, I think it can. But because I guess I had a bit of an anti-establishment streak in me, which was that, well, let's make things available and free. You know what I mean? I think that's nice. But so I was thinking about how Wikipedia is a non-profit and how Khan Academy is also a non-profit. And I guess the clicking point of when I decided, oh, maybe it's actually better to go for a for-profit for this one, is because maybe it was one of those days that when I loaded Wikipedia, half the page was asking for a donation. And then at the same day, I used Google a whole bunch of times, and I never got interrupted by anything. And I also then, there was also this clicking of, just a second, Google did start with Google search. But then because they were able to roll their profits into a very strong engineering team, they were able to use their engineering team to build something else I use called Google Maps. And then they also built something called Gmail. And they actually built the whole web browser I'm using, as well as the phone I'm using, and the Chromebook that's in front of me. So what I realized is, actually, if you have already had the ability to assemble a superstar team, being in a situation where you're able to make profits, take investment, you deploy the investment and profits to build more product, will put you in a situation where you can actually create even more wealth to the world. So I was also influenced by the observation that there was an enormous amount of excellent research created in the middle of the last century by an entity called AT&T Bell Labs. And many of the earth-shaking inventions came from there. That's the research laboratory for a very, very successful for-profit. And so personally, I mean, assuming that I will still have control of the enterprise, if we actually did become that big, I mean, this is actually what I would want to do too, right? So then I realized that, wait a second, if there actually is a market opportunity here, you can actually take those profits and plow them in and create entities and foundations that can go and finance the entire nonprofit education sector. Maybe that's better than competing with the entire nonprofit education sector for donations. And I should add why I think there's actually even a business here. I actually want what you see here to be free right now. I because my philosophy right now, I mean, my philosophy is, and I hope that it can be done as long as I maintain control of this project, my philosophy is that it actually costs me almost nothing to provide an interactive experience delivered through our website, because those are just bits of data going back and forth. The variable cost of running a server to deliver to an individual user this interactive experience is a fraction of a penny. We actually even currently use YouTube to route our videos, so we don't even pay for that bandwidth. Of course, YouTube gets the ad revenue, but that's okay. YouTube can have their ad revenue. We just want content out there, right? But if that doesn't really cost us that much to run, in theory, we don't need to charge for it. And that's actually why the product you see is free. It's, the world has created it together, and we're distributing it for free. Now, if the website actually does get as popular as Wikipedia, I think there's also a fundamental difference between, say, the Wikipedia market and the education market. Fundamental difference is that 15 years ago, before Wikipedia, if I was chatting with a friend and we were arguing about whether a centipede had 100 legs or not, we wouldn't be able to resolve that. Now we can. We go to Wikipedia. Great. You know, we pull it out of our pocket. We go, yeah, you see, it doesn't have 100 legs. But 15 years ago, we weren't used to paying someone to resolve that conflict. So if now today there's Wikipedia, and Wikipedia said, thanks, I just told you a centipede doesn't have 100 legs. Could you please pay me a quarter? We'd say, what do you mean? I don't pay a quarter for that. Here's another analogy, Facebook. I mean, 20 years ago, if I give a friend a photograph, or maybe that's a bad example because I have to print the photograph, but if I say something to a friend or call him on the phone, I don't really pay him. It's a flat rate phone, right? And so when Facebook came around, they couldn't suddenly say, you need to pay to have friends, right? So both of these markets, the Facebook market and the Wikipedia market, are not places where you expect money to flow from consumers. Facebook, of course, makes an enormous amount of money from advertisements. In the education space, my current thought is I don't think we'll even need advertisements, because there's actually a $1 trillion money flow in the education space, period. A lot of it is for human-provided services like tutoring or certification. And so the objective of XP is build this resource that the whole world can use for free, finance the resource by offering value-added services that go into this trillion-dollar market, and if there are 100 million people using the main product, some fraction of them, the ones with money, will be interested in the value-added services if you're actually delivering good services and actually for a more reasonable price because it's being done on the internet more efficiently. The revenue from there will offset the cost of running the free service that teaches everyone from Nicaragua to Peru to New York City. So that's actually how the business model is structured. The idea is there's almost no variable cost here, so set the price to zero and then grow the site and monetize from the people who have money, essentially redistributing the wealth to people who do not have money. That was intriguing to investors because actually in some sense, if you're building the website that will be the place that anyone goes to learn math and science and eventually other subjects, and it's a $1 trillion market, there's something there. So that's actually why I decided to go with the for-profit structure instead of the non-profit structure. And the hope is that someday, if this actually is immensely valuable, we'll even be able to route the money back in to help in ways that we can't do with our core competency, which happens to be technology.
Absolutely. That's an absolutely beautiful vision for what you're building. As far as the clients or other organizations that you work with, I know this is something that's still growing, but we mentioned some involvement with the Environmental Charter School, a school here in Pittsburgh. Of the different teachers, faculty that are using XP as a part of their curriculum, what kind of feedback have you gotten, both positive and negative? And when you hear that negative feedback, what is your process for evaluating the validity of the negative criticism and making a change?
Yeah. So I would say that right now, the number of users on XP is actually very, very, very small in the sense that it's a contribution community. The people who are using it to consume are generally people who, I guess, have learned about it and are curious and are intrigued. But we specifically didn't make a huge effort to broadcast this far and wide because I've learned a lot from our designers on our team who know way more than I do about that entire side of life and business. And rather than putting a product out in front of the whole world, which is not ready for mass consumption, it's better to iterate where you're showing it to small groups at a time, getting that feedback, learning from that feedback. And after you think you've actually managed to satisfy almost all of the concerns that you can, then you open up the gates and you try to bring everyone in. So right now, the teachers who have heard about it are teachers who I've met through, say, meetups in Pittsburgh. I've been going around to meetups of teachers. We sponsored an event called Startup Weekend Education in Pittsburgh, and that was actually at the Environmental Charter School. That's how I met some of their administration and faculty. And I mean, in terms of feedback I've received some. There was a teacher I met there who I met at another meetup a month later, and that teacher told me, I've been addicted to your site. I've just been browsing around and reading the articles. They're really interesting. And I said, wow, that's great. I didn't actually realize that they were ready for consumption, because these are just being created by people who are enthusiastic and interested. However, apparently it already has value there. We also went and exhibited at a trade show where 9,000 math teachers converged. This was the biggest meeting of math teachers every year, and it happened to be in Boston this year. And the feedback that we got, that was also extremely positive from the teachers. when I showed up at the booth, I showed up a day late, and the booth next to us was a group that I knew, and I asked them, how are you doing? And that person who was sitting there said, wow, your booth is doing really well. I just keep hearing teachers exclaiming how this is awesome. You know, I was coming in after the first day, right? So this was what the nearby booth was thinking of what was going on in our booth. And the teachers were really engaged. They had never seen something like this before, which actually puts into their hands the ability to make these interactive lessons. I should say, the very important thing that this adds is it makes it so you don't have to be a programmer to create a lesson that combines video, question and answer, pictures, diagrams. You can actually just do those as easily as if, almost as if you were writing in Word. Maybe a little bit more complicated, but still the barrier to entry was very, very, very low. And so when the teachers saw this, they were pretty excited. Now, of course, we got feedback, which is very useful also, negative feedback. In fact, in some sense, if you don't get negative feedback, you're not learning how to improve. And we totally want negative. We want to learn from negative feedback. How we respond to that is, I'm very, very happy that our lead designer is a person who is a CMU student who actually ran a student organization that's devoted to hacking. Not hacking in a bad way. It's called Scotty Labs. They create a lot of they bring together a lot of students who create interesting projects, and he's a designer. And what I've learned from working with him and his team is that you want to take the feedback, which may be negative, and you want to break it down. You don't want, if someone just says, I don't like it, you ask them, why don't you like it? You know, what are the parts that you don't like? You start to identify the pain points that they're having. And you also want to know, what do you want to do? You understand their objective. So as you start to learn what their objective is and how the site currently is not letting them achieve their objective, you realize that, yes, this needs to get fixed. And generally, I mean, I have this philosophy, not that I have, I follow this philosophy that's been well said by many people, which is that the user is right. In some sense, we're making a site for users. And if users are saying that they're confused and don't know how to go from point A to point B, well, you better show them, right? So we actually really want to see all of these negative feedbacks. And that's actually why we are slowly getting our site to get more and more publicity. We want to be able to see these feedback, hear these feedbacks first, iterate on them, improve, and then release to more and more people.
That's great. That's about all the time that we have for today. We're going to wrap up with Poe issuing a challenge for the listeners. So I'm going to hand the mic over to him one last time. Poe, take it away.
Great. So what I would say is that, can I give two challenges?
Go for it.
Because the first one is a general one, and the second one is about XP itself, because I think the general one is also very important. So for the general one, what I would say is look at life and try to find some situation where everyone is doing something some way, but they're actually all wrong. So that's actually where some of this mathematical, creative, problem-solving thinking comes in. It's that, in my opinion, there are a lot of situations in life where things are being done just because that's how they were done last year. Actually, this is just true, and at some point, that's just how they're always done. That doesn't mean they're the best way to do it. That's actually how XP was started. It's just that you look at what everyone's doing, and maybe you think that they're wrong. By the way, you might be wrong. But at least find something where you think everyone else is wrong, and then dwell on that for a while and see whether or not you're right. I'll say that 99% of the time, you're wrong. this is my experience. Most of the time, I'm wrong. But sometimes I'm right. But those rare times when you're right are moments of opportunity. Something I would also, the other call to action is regarding XP, in the sense that, again, what we're trying to do is we're trying to improve the interest in math and science throughout the entire world. And if we think that this is actually going to dramatically improve the human condition. So if you know any students or teachers or other people who are interested in education at all, there's something we're trying to do right now, which is to identify interesting videos which are already on YouTube, which can help to illuminate concepts in math and science. Either you could do this, or you could find people who might like to do this. Find the video, put it on XP, share these nuggets with the world, and you can do your part also to increase the interest in math and science worldwide.
That's a great challenge, Poe. That's expii.com. I think we're going to have a lot of people at the very least checking it out. I'm sure some contributors will come from this. if anyone wants to connect with you or with XP in general, outside of the website, is there any way that they can connect with you either on Twitter or something like that?
Absolutely. So on Twitter, we have a handle, XP Inc. That's E-X-P-I-I-I-N-C. We also have a Facebook page. The Facebook page is also XP Inc. And in general, we'll be running our campaigns, our information campaigns through these too. And feel free to communicate, tweet to us, message us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
Great. We just went deep with Po Shen Lo of XP.com, among many other impressive accomplishments. Thank you to him for sharing his late morning with me, and to everyone out there listening. Have a great day.
Thanks.
There for listening to that episode. Once again, I apologize for the sound quality. We will continue to try to do better in that regard moving forward. If you want to continue to connect with the show, stay up to date on everything that's coming up with the blog, I encourage you to follow us at AaronWatson59 on Twitter and to check out the website at goingdeepwithaaron.com. There will be show notes for this and all episodes of the podcast at the website. You can get links to XP.com, other information about Poe, some other interesting stuff there. Until next time, this has been the Going Deep Podcast. Hope everyone has a great day.